Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of a recent episode exploring the history of investors holding businesses accountable and the dawn of the ESG, or Environmental Social Governance, movement.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. When quarantine measures spread across the U.S. in mid-March, the love lives of many people changed dramatically. New couples had to decide whether they could make it long distance. Living together meant quarantining together, and living alone suddenly felt vastly different. And months later, we continue to feel these disruptions. On Point listener Duncan Newberry has been married for 9 years. When he arrived home on March 12th, after working abroad for many months, he had a very different idea of what his homecoming would look like. He joins us now from Cottage Grove, Oregon, to tell us his story. Duncan, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you.
So how was it going from a long-distance relationship while you were working overseas to then coming home and quarantining together 24/7? How'd it go for you?
Well, it was challenging, for sure. I'd spent several months planning all of these things that we were going to do when I got home. We were going to go to the beach. We were going to go get a hotel, go see movies, go out, do things with the kids. And then none of that happened. And we were just home, maybe going for a walk or a bike ride. I had to quarantine for a couple of weeks when I got home personally because there had been infections where I was coming through on the way home.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was teleworking for about two months from my house with four children and my wife.
And how was that? Homeschooling four kids, teleworking. How did that affect your marriage?
Well, you know, it was challenging, but it's a challenge that I'm really happy that I have, because I know that there are a lot of folks out there who don't have relationships or have relationships that aren't actually very stable or good, and mine is pretty good. So it's hard, but my wife and I can talk about these things, and the reason I called you guys is that, like, one of the things I've really noticed is that both of us have started being like, I need some space in some way or another. I need to go for a bike ride. I need to go read a book. Or I need to just take a walk around the yard. And I think that in that sense, it's actually been a productive thing for us to learn how to be. We used to just have space naturally because I would go to work and she had her things that she would do. And we had our time apart. And now we have to actually be conscious of that time that we need to have for ourselves.
And so what have you learned about yourself through this experience?
That I'm not quite as extroverted as I thought. I do actually need to be alone sometimes. It gives me an opportunity to improve my ability to be a husband. It's almost like you're in a pressure cooker a little bit. Everything's a little more intense, but it also gives you more opportunities to be better at being a partner, boyfriend, husband, parent. So that's been good.
I am super
grateful that I have a partner that I can work through these things with and do these things with, because I feel like the part of my life where I was alone for a long time, it would have been a lot harder to go through this, and I have somebody that's on my side.
Duncan Newberry, On Point listener, who just came home from working overseas and quarantined, and I appreciate your courage and willing to talk with us about that experience. Duncan, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Good luck to you and your family. Let me bring in now from Hoboken, New Jersey, Ashley Fetters. Ashley is a reporter who's been writing about relationships during the pandemic. You can find her piece from the New York Times headlined, Move In, Get Divorced, The Pandemic Forces Couples to Decide. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Ashley, welcome to the program. Nice to have you. Ashley, are you there?
Oh, yes. Can you hear me, Jane?
Yes. Thank you. Good to have
you.
That's all right.
So good to be here.
Thank you. Well, love during a pandemic in all its complexity. You wrote this really interesting piece in The Times. What were you trying to unveil in your reporting? What did you want to find?
Yeah. So one of the things that's shown up in my reporting throughout the pandemic is, you know, that among couples who are, you know, further along in their relationships, who know each other really well, who are maybe married or maybe have, you know, been in an established relationship for a while, either being extremely together or being suddenly apart, just gave them a lot of new insights and new clarity. You know, touches on what Duncan was describing, but I spoke to one couple, for example, who had been putting off getting engaged because they were just too busy. Up kind of throwing it together a really sweet little engagement the night before they both went into lockdown with their separate families. And now, as of a few weeks ago, they're married. And I, you know, I spoke to another man who had been laid off from his job, a nighttime job, and you know, suddenly found as his wife several years quickly was that they had just grown apart. Like all they had in common anymore was their kids who are now, so, they decided to split up and both did force a lot of people into whatever, but a lot of people came out with more clear decisions that they were making.
We're going to work on your line, Ashley. And for the moment, let me bring in another voice here from St. Louis, Missouri. Lex Brown James is a licensed marriage and family therapist and founder of the Institute for Sexuality and Intimacy. Lex, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, Jane.
So you're a marriage and family therapist. I'm curious what you're seeing in your practice right now related to the pandemic and how couples and folks are dealing with intimacy.
So, yeah, as a marriage and family therapist, as also a PhD in human sexuality, I get a great span of folks looking for different things. And in practice, I'm seeing a little bit of the gamut. So I see singles and individuals who are really longing for physical touch, who are really longing to try and find a special somebody. I also work with some consensual non-monogamous folks who are figuring out what their boundaries are and how to still see their lovers and partners. And I also see couples who have decided to dedicate themselves to their relationship, that maybe it was easier to have distractions when they were out and about and working. And these folks are now at home and decided to end extramarital affairs and really dedicate themselves, or trying to reconnect and rekindle the intimacy with each other while they're quarantining together.
What is it exactly that changes in a relationship when you're with someone all the time, when there's no space, when work is on the couch, when you can't get out? What changes from your perspective as a therapist?
Well, that is something that Duncan started to attest to, right? So coming home from abroad and having this kind of honeymoon period, when you're spending 40, 60, 75 hours at a job, you see a relationship and you get these little honeymoon periods of like, we just get to watch an hour of TV together, or now's our time to bond with our kids. And then when we reverse that, right? Because screen time burnout is real and people are almost, if they have the privilege, getting some grace around work schedule. So now it's like, who is this person that I'm with? And you get to see a little bit of their work persona, which may be different than their lover persona. And you're like, are you that person at work who does that? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
Because work is right there on the couch, right? You get to see how your partner
exactly is
at work, right? You have different insights.
And I can hear you. I can hear you in this other room. And your computer's open. You sign emails like this? Yeah. Oh, I have questions now. Who are you? And so we're really getting to know those partnerships. And then when we add in finding out that individual time, those crafts, those books, those cooking endeavors, and figuring out that division of labor in households, that's all new for some folks.
Mm-hmm. And the pandemic has also forced people to face relationship problems that they've been avoiding, maybe, right? Fast track some conversations that have been put on the back burner, Lex.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. So I'm seeing folks who, when the idea of being locked down with a lover, they were like, yes, we're going to be able to be as intimate as much as we want to. And then they figured out that, whoa, I don't want 24 hours of marathon bedroom time. I want to do something else. Or they start to realize, I really don't like this. We need to change this. And I didn't realize I didn't like this until we had to go through all of the time, right? Mm-hmm. And when that comes up for folks, now they're trying to figure out, how do we have this conversation? And that also goes to parenting style. People are now parenting for longer periods of time because children aren't at school, or they have to have a different division of labor where one parent might have taken care of a child for most of the day, and that's not feasible. And so there's learning new skill sets on top of navigating these boundaries with a lover.
Ashley Fetters, talk about those conversations. You called them love confessions of quarantine. Tell us about those.
Sure. Sorry about the glitches earlier, by the way. Home studio recording is a real challenge. But something else that showed up in my reporting kind of early in the pandemic was lots of people ended up confessing their crushes to people that they liked, or to the person they had feelings for. I spoke to several people who were worried about how dangerous the situation had become suddenly, and were just thinking, wow, I might never see this person again. You know, we might not survive. So I have to tell them how I feel, that's sort of the more serious and more grave version of that situation. But on a much lighter note, I did talk to some other people who felt like the lockdown had actually made it easier and more convenient to express their feelings. Like, lots of college students who I talked to said, maybe I'll never see this person from my calculus class or my biology class again. So maybe I should just get this off my chest now, because I won't have to worry about running into this person again if it goes badly. So lots of people just kind of took this opportunity, or took this scary situation as a signal to, make their feelings known.
No time for pretense. Couples mm-hmm. deciding to get engaged, even married during quarantine, Ashley.
That's right. Yeah, I did talk to a couple who, I don't know if this came through earlier. I was trying to describe this situation, but I talked to a couple in Canada who, had kind of been putting off their engagement. They had meant to start thinking about a wedding, but just had too much going on with work and travel. And, as soon as the lockdown went into effect and their families were going to be separated and they were going to be apart for a while, they said they drove out to their favorite spot in the middle of a snowstorm, got engaged, got back in the car, drove right back, and quarantined separately for another couple of weeks while they planned part of their wedding. Mm. So, a sweet story. Mm. And they kind of got them to the place where they wanted to be anyway.
We are discussing love and relationships during the coronavirus pandemic. And we have more to come with Ashley Fetters, Lex Brown James, and your calls and comments. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make, that's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big whoa kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about how the pandemic is making people rethink their love lives during this very unusual times. I'm speaking this hour with Ashley Fetters, a reporter who's been writing on this subject, and Lex Brown James. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist and founder of the Institute for Sexuality and Intimacy. Here's a clip from one of our listeners, Bethany from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. She left us this message about her long-distance relationship. It's a new one.
My girlfriend, Mandy, and I have been dating for about a month, and we met online, and we have had multiple Zoom dates, and it's been going really well. We've been sharing stories, we've been watching movies and shows together, and something that I've really enjoyed is that we've been reading a book together. We each have a copy of the same book, and we read passages to each other, and it's been really wonderful. I'm really glad, and I'm very lucky to have her in my life.
Ashley Fetters, this is a new concept, Zoom dating. Talk to us about this in your reporting at the New York Times. Ashley?
Never really. Oh, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Zoom dating is, you know, one of these things that we are collectively as a society having to get used to, obviously. You know, it's wonderful what she just said about, you know, reading a book together, right, and having, you know, something to do together while they're apart, right? Everything, every relationship expert or every couples therapist or every, you know, the love and relationships counselor that I talks to me about how one of the things that keeps love alive and keeps romance going and keeps people attached to each other is having shared memories of things that they've done together. And, you know, when you are suddenly facing this quarantine that keeps you apart for a long time, it's really hard to create shared memories because you're just not together and you can't really be. Doing something like reading a book together is a perfect way, I think, to just create shared memories and create, you know, things to go back to when you know, one of the purposes that those shared memories serve is when you're feeling a little bit more, you know, annoyed or just a little bit frustrated with your relationship, you can remember those fond things together and remember why you're there in the first place. And, you know, that's exactly what they're doing. They're creating these wonderful memories together that they can return to when they need them.
So as we're emerging from quarantine and Zoom dating turns into real dating, Lex Brown James, you know, we have interesting questions now about consent. Do you feel safe meeting in person? Do you agree to wear a mask on the first date? Do you feel comfortable being less than 6 feet apart? You know, how are you seeing this in your practice?
So for those folks who are single and dating, also for those folks who are polyamorous and meeting up with different members of their polycule, it is a long discussion of consent, but also before we meet up, right? So are we quarantining before our date that we're going to meet up? And then what does that look like afterwards? Super important, specifically for multi-generational households or households where people might have disabilities or be impacted and have autoimmune disorders, right? Or even if they're working with frontliner folks. So looking at consent conversations and also what we feel safe for body safe practices. So New York came out with an amazing list of ways to be body safe during COVID when you're working with physical intimacy and closeness, and then choosing those things that are a little bit less risk. So maybe we don't go sit at a restaurant, maybe we go to a park, and maybe we do stay 6 feet, or maybe we've both been quarantining and we have access to get a COVID test and we get our results back and we share those results, and then we feel safer holding hands and then wash hands afterwards, right? So starting to take those precautions and then how they apply to us for what feels safe and then also what feels doable for our bodies is part of that intimacy building conversation. Because it's saying, do you care about my health too? Mm-hmm. And how are you showing me that you're caring about my health?
Ashley Futters, you know, with precarious financial situations for lots of people, you know, making decisions are coming now partly for love, but partly to save money, right? For financial reasons. What did you find?
Certainly. Well, one thing that, you know, kind of the party line, I guess you could say, in a lot of, you know, relationship therapy circles and, you know, among folks that I talk to about this is that you should decide not slide into cohabitation. It's a decision you should make together, you know, and then be really thoughtful and intentional about. And when I talked to Alexandra Solomon, who's a professor at Northwestern about this and a clinical psychologist, she said that the pandemic has really made her realize just how privileged a position that is, because, you know, you are seeing mass economic devastation all over. Lots of people can't make their rent payments, and so they're kind of coming up with creative solutions to having housing during this pandemic. And one of those creative solutions is moving in with a partner, or, you know, some people are moving in with friends, but other people are kind of saying, like, well, let's speed up this conversation about moving in together because now it's a necessity and not a luxury. And I talked to one person who had moved in with their partner, you know, just partially out of finance reasons, but partially because they had been quarantining together and realized they just really liked sharing a space and really, you know, felt that they were prepared for living together permanently. So it's given a lot of couples and a lot of people the opportunity to discuss living together. It maybe earlier than they might have discussed it otherwise.
And are those what you describe as quarantine pods or quarantine bubbles, Ashley?
I think of quarantine pods and quarantine bubbles as like multiple households. So I guess that's, you know, that's more of a like two people becoming a single household. Mm-hmm. But yeah, quarantine bubbles is something that I think is really interesting. And, you know, it's like Lex was saying, you have to have this very serious conversation about consent and about exclusivity and about what other people are you seeing if we're going to be in a pod together. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it's given us a good vocabulary for talking about how do we prioritize this person in their life and what sacrifices are we willing to make to be with them? Mm-hmm. But yeah, quarantine pods is like, it's a real exercise in having a hard conversation about where where someone is a priority in your life.
So give us an example of that, Ashley.
Sure. So someone I had talked to about this had mentioned that, you know, she... how did this, I'm trying to remember how this went, but I'm fairly sure that she was seeing someone who, they weren't exclusive yet, but she wanted to keep seeing him during the pandemic. And so, you know, they had to have this quick conversation about like, well, you know, if we're going to be a quarantine pod, we kind of have to stop seeing other people. We have to, you know, put each other's safety first, right? And really prioritize it, keeping each other safe. So we have to cut out other people from our lives in order to be able to hang out together and keep dating in person, or like keep, you know, having sleepovers, or keep seeing each other. And so that just kind of, again, sped along a conversation that might not have happened until much later otherwise.
Lex Brown-James, in your marriage and family therapy practice, have you seen an uptick in divorce during this time of pandemic?
So I am usually the last stop that people come to before they decide to divorce. And part of my practice is to table divorcing or separating while we're in therapy so we can really dedicate to ourselves. So what I am seeing is, and what globally we're seeing, right? So it's actually a global phenomenon. We are seeing more people file for divorce. And a lot of times it is the person who identifies as female and the woman in the relationship who is starting to file for divorce because they no longer want that relationship with people returning home from work, with them feeling that workloads are not being shared, that they're not being supported. People are really realizing that this relationship isn't the best for them. This parenting style, this family style isn't the best for them. And they're starting to initiate some of their rights. The issue is with, of course, everything going on, there are severe delays. And so delays in courts, delays in being able to file paperwork, being able to get a separation stay. And people are a little bit in limbo with being able to end something and move out of a house or not have that legal obligation anymore. Mm-hmm.
Ashley, is Lex's experience reflected in your reporting?
Yeah, from what I've seen, you know, I think one of the landmark things that a lot of people refer to when they talk about divorce post-pandemic is the numbers that came out of China when the courts opened back up and people started to come out of quarantine. A lot of them had realized, you know, I don't want to be in this marriage anymore. And I do think, you know, it's very likely that it has to do with, you know, division of labor suddenly being very obviously unbalanced, right? One of the things that the pandemic did is really lay bare just how much people do in the workplace and, or sorry, how much people do at home while their spouse is at the workplace, if that's the division of labor, right? And it just, it made visible people's families and it made visible childcare in a way that it hadn't been before. So, you know, when everything is visible that way, people start to realize like, oh, the way that we're dividing labor is totally unfair. And if it can't change, then maybe we shouldn't be together.
And so, Lex, are you seeing that as well? The divisions of labor amplified among couples during this time?
Absolutely. One of my dear colleagues I do with cancer survivors, prostate cancer survivors, talked about his partner, his wife, was talking about how he took out the trash. It was literally like, why are you taking out the trash like that? And he's like, are we really talking about trash? And so these little conflicts of things start to be a little bit more amplified around division of labor. If your lover doesn't do the dishes the way you prefer to do the dishes, if somebody is barely missing the hamper with their t-shirt, now the t-shirt's on the floor, right? Also with children. So watching over children, watching over teens, and that division of labor can start to feel unfair. It can start to feel overwhelming. And then people realize, I don't know if I have the skill set to do this. And it becomes a shocker and also a potential point of conflict for couples that can lead to that breaking.
Well, let me get another perspective here at this point, and we'll go to Washington, D.C. to speak with Amy Fowler. She's a marine biologist. She's been quarantining in her one-bedroom apartment with her cat and dog during this time. Amy, welcome to On Point. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you so much.
So what has this experience of quarantine during this pandemic been like for you?
I think, you know, the number one word is lonely. I've lived alone for almost 3 years now, and in that time I've had lonely days, but in this time of 5 months, you know, working alone, living alone, everything like that, it's rough.
Mm-hmm. You wrote in a tweet, I haven't hugged a human since February 10th. I've lived alone 2,000 plus miles away from my family and friends for almost 3 years. And even on my worst days in those 3 years, I've never felt before such crushing loneliness than I do now, every day. When did it hit you, Amy, how hard this would be for you?
I think it was probably around May. I tried to go home to see my family for Memorial Day. And once I realized that wasn't on the table and I didn't know when that was going to be an option again, that was when it really started to hit me that this was going to be a long haul and it was going to be a lonely haul.
And a lot of, you know, a lot of people talk about, well, I'll pick up a hobby during this time. I'll do something to, you know, kind of busy myself or relieve the pain of it all. How have you been coping?
I picked up knitting again. I feel like it's a very classic, somewhat spinster activity, living alone. But I've been, you know, taking my dog out for walks. I'm very thankful that he gets me out of the house at least every day. So I think that's been really helpful for me. Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people focus on parenting and homeschooling children and, you know, relationships with a partner and sort of the back and forth of that during this time. We really shouldn't ignore the mental health implications of loneliness. How has this impacted you and your mental health?
You know, I certainly don't envy any parents trying to navigate this time. I think nobody is having a good time right now. But it's been a hard time trying to deal with mental health by myself. You know, I was in therapy, but with insurance changes, I had to drop that. And so that's something I'm looking forward to getting started again.
At one point, I know you'd looked at a job as a marine biologist on a remote island. Would you consider a job like that now after having this experience, Amy?
I think so. I think I was just talking to my mom. She's not willing to watch my dog for 6 months. But if that wasn't in the picture, I think I would apply for that job.
You would.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it would be a fantastic opportunity and something different.
Even if you were alone on a remote island by yourself, having lived through all this.
I think with a satellite phone, I think I could make it work.
Amy Fowler, good luck to you. I really appreciate your time today and sharing your experience. Thank you and all the best.
Thank you so much.
Lex Brown-James, let me bring you back in here. Amy's story is familiar to many during these last few months. What did you hear there?
Yeah, I see Amy reflected in my own clientele who are longing that hug feeling. It's something that we call skin hunger. And everybody has this, right? So humans need human touch to survive. We know this. And that just craving of another human being, whether it be a hug, a pat on the back, a cuddle of some sort. I'm glad that Amy does have their pets with them, because at least that is another heartbeat next to yours or something of that manner. But we do have people who are quarantining alone, and we've seen plant gardens and people becoming plant parents because it's giving them something to take care of, and they feel like they do get feedback and watching their plants being able to flourish and grow. But that is something that is real around loneliness and depression, and also some anxiety. So we're also seeing people that are scared to go out of the house and who are isolating because they work at frontline jobs and don't want to have the potential to infect or harm anyone else. So we're seeing it on both ends in the mental health field here.
Ashley Fetters, I don't think enough people understand the difficulty of living alone, especially during this unusual, this peculiar time.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. And I wonder what Lex would say about this. But one thing that I have seen come up in my reporting and in my own life, too, is that, you know, loneliness is one of these feelings that it's really hard to recognize in normal times. You know, so many of us are so busy that we just don't stop and think about, you know, the fact that maybe we feel sad or maybe we feel irritable or maybe we just feel a little bit off because we might be lonely. But kind of the pandemic really underlined, you know, this is what it's like to feel lonely. It really gave people a vocabulary for, you know, this feeling is because I have not seen any of my friends. I have not seen the people I love. I have not been able to give a hug to someone I love. So I think it's, you know, it's a new experience for a lot of people, but I think in the future it'll be something of a helpful one. Like, I think people will be better recognizing this feeling in the future.
Do you agree with that, Lex?
I do. And when Ashley was talking, it really brought up my teens. So I do see some teens and youth in my practice, and them, we know that this is an important developmental time, right? So it's really when they start to solidify their group identity versus their individual selves. And they're also really suffering from not being in classes and not being able to hang out. So yes, I do think they have a whole new vocabulary and access to coping mechanisms now.
We are diving into relationships during the pandemic, from Zoom dates to couples quarantining together at home, what it means for everyone. Ashley Fetters is my guest. She's a New York Times correspondent. Her piece is headlined, Move In, Get Divorced, The Pandemic Forces Couples to Decide. And Lex Brown-James, a licensed marriage and family therapist at the Institute for Sexuality and Intimacy. Much more to come after this break. Listeners, we'll be right back. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about love and relationships during the coronavirus pandemic. I want to share these clips, the open source platform Corona Diaries from the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard is documenting personal stories during the COVID-19 pandemic through audio diaries. Here's a man in San Francisco describing a new birthday ritual for his wife, who turned 74 back in April.
Normally on our birthdays, we go out to a nice restaurant and have a good dinner and a bottle of wine. But on this occasion, since all the restaurants are closed, I prepared the entire meal, which included a saute with peanut sauce and a cucumber salad and a chocolate tunnel cake. I haven't made a cake since I was probably 10. I'm now 71. So that was a major positive experience coming out of the lockdown.
Here's another Corona Diary story. This one comes from Heilbrunn, Germany. In April, the speaker's wife is a pediatrician on the front line of the pandemic. He's trying to support her while he works from home.
I'm also proud that she can help in the situation in a way that I cannot, and I try to support her in ways possible for me, cooking her meals, seeing that the flat is clean and something like that, which is my part that I could contribute.
It's a great story. To listen to more Corona Diaries and submit your own, you can find a link at our website, onpointradio.org. So love and relationships during the coronavirus, it can get complicated. I'm speaking with Ashley Fetters, a reporter at the New York Times. She's been working on this, writing about this subject. Lex Brown James, a licensed marriage and family therapist in St. Louis, Missouri. And joining me now from Boston, Massachusetts, is Miriam Wasser and Mike Langone. Miriam is a former producer here at On Point. She is now a reporter at WBUR. Miriam and Mike got married last month in an outdoor ceremony. Welcome to you both and congratulations.
Thanks, Jane. Good to be with you.
So you guys got married on July 11th in a small, socially distanced affair, as I understand it. Tell me about it, Miriam.
Yeah, so we got engaged not too long before the pandemic really started, and we were planning to have a big 200-person-plus wedding. We both just have lots of friends. I have a huge family, and we were figuring things out. But then as it became clear that gatherings of that size weren't going to work out, we scaled down our idea and had heard of other people doing a wedding over Zoom. And, you know, it wasn't our top choice of idea, but it worked out really well. And I think we both kind of came to terms with what it was.
So tell me about the Zoom aspect. How many people did you Zoom in for the ceremony?
I think we Zoomed in about 90.
I think, yeah, about 100.
90
something.
People or so. So the total number of people probably ended up being right around where we initially planned, probably around 200.
And what was that like, seeing your guests over Zoom at your wedding, Miriam?
It was actually, it was really nice. I kind of went into it thinking that I wouldn't pay attention to the Zoom at all. And I will fully admit that during the ceremony, I was not even aware of the cell phone cameras. But afterwards, you know, we held up the laptop and just took a few minutes to say hello to people. And it was surprisingly meaningful. It was really, really lovely to see all of our friends there and all of our families. And some of our friends dressed up, and, you know, one of my friends put her dog in a little tuxedo, and it was really special.
Mike, what was that like for you, seeing your wedding guests over Zoom?
It was fantastic. I mean, we're obviously the only ones that didn't watch the actual Zoom call, but we heard it was, you know, like a typical Zoom call with people forgetting to mute and such. So it was amazing to, at the end of the ceremony, to be able to see everyone together and friends that I hadn't honestly seen in so many months. I mean, the last mm-hmm. time you see them, they might have short hair, and then on the Zoom, they suddenly have shoulder length hair.
The Zoom cut.
It was a really interesting experience. Yeah.
So, Miriam, it all worked out, right? But cutting down the list was pretty hard, and at times very emotional for you. Who could not come, and who could come to your socially distanced affair?
Yeah, we had a hard time with that. We initially came up with this. So, you know, we whittled down the list from about 200 to, I think it was about 40. And that would have included a lot of our really close friends and a lot of family. And we presented that list to our moms. And they were sort of the ones who had to, you know, deliver the tough news that we couldn't do something that big. So that was really hard. I had a really hard time with the fact that my best friends weren't going to be there. So I will admit, I think I definitely cried on a couple of occasions, but it worked out. And, you know, before the ceremony, a bunch of my girlfriends and I got together on a Zoom, and that was really, really special. And, you know, I had just gotten my hair kind of braided. And so I was showing that off, showing them my dress. And it was, you know, it was very kind of traditional and girly in some ways, but it was great to see everyone.
Are you going on a honeymoon?
We are. We're going backpacking. We're actually leaving tomorrow.
Yeah, we're going backpacking for 3 weeks and not see another person. So perfect honeymoon for a pandemic.
Even on Zoom, right? Nobody, even on Zoom. Well, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your wedding story, your pandemic love story. We appreciate it. And all the best to you. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Jane.
Thanks, Jane. It was great to talk to you.
Good to hear from you again. Miriam Wasser and Mike Langone. So there's a story, Ashley Fetters, one of many I know you've covered. Zoom weddings, families, friends joining with technology where they can, Ashley.
Yes, certainly. I mean, it's one of the you know, sort of silver linings, I would say, to the pandemic is like it really made us get creative about how we celebrate big life events, birthday parties, weddings, you know, any like graduations especially had to get very creative this year. And, you know, there is going to be something really memorable for this whole generation of people who lived through this about this year and, you know, what kinds of adjustments and what kinds of creative solutions they had to come up with. I think a Zoom wedding is going to be something that's so unique to this particular kind of micro generation of adults right now. You know, there will be just a micro generation, a cohort of people who look back and say like, well, you know, we couldn't have a wedding, so, you know, we had a Zoom wedding, and that's just what everyone our age did at that time, which is going to be really interesting in the future to look back on that.
Lex Brownwater, James, do you think that this moment could reshape the dating culture into the future as we talk about technology and how that's now integrated into our love lives, to be quite frank?
Oh, absolutely. So not only with the Zoom weddings, which congratulations, I love and amplifying love, but also the care that people are taking. So now we're seeing people saying, I'll send you a meal, right? Do you feel safe with a delivery service coming to your house? Or let me Venmo you money for some groceries and we can cook together. And they're taking the time to really build that connection, which is something that youth have been actually doing. So we see all of the social media folks, they're reaching out to 50, 100, hundreds, thousands of people, depending on a following, and sharing a message and sharing silly, fun, multi-generational videos and discovering music from other generations and times. And all of that memory building is building intimate connection. And we're starting to see that through the use of tech. And then as well as with intimacy too, right? So there are long distance intimacy devices. There are things that come with remote controls. And people are also engaging in that type of play too, to say, hey, just thinking about you. And I want to show you some pleasure too.
Well, let me turn for a moment to another topic, because I think it's important to recognize that the pandemic and this period of quarantine for many people has been hard and even dangerous if they are in abusive relationships. Here is Susan Leonard. She's a professor of gender and culture studies at Simmons University in Boston. She spoke to us about the dangers of abusive relationships during the pandemic.
Our research is finding not so much that it's kind of forcing people to do things they wouldn't have done, but more it's left them with a lack of options, right? So there's research to show that kind of really dangerous relationships, abusive relationships have gotten worse. There's also just a sense that people feel really stuck, right? They feel really stuck in relationships. But when, you know, this is not a time probably when people can, you know, move out or separate.
In fact, the National Domestic Violence Hotline says calls, texts, and online chats increased 9% to more than 62,000 nationwide from mid-March to mid-May compared to the same period last year. Lex, you know, when couples have external stress, it affects how they interact with each other, sometimes in dangerous ways.
Oh my gosh, yeah. And we're also seeing a loss of a lot of privilege, right? So financially impacted folks, people who are impacted for health, people who are impacted by losing care that they've had before. And it's been hard because there's been less than 20 states that exempted domestic violence survivors from stay-at-home orders. And even less than that, I think it's like 5 states that named shelters as essential businesses. And we don't have all of the resources in place. And so when people are in those power dynamic situations where abuses of power over another person are being had on a regular basis, they go to extreme. And the more powerless a person feels, the more likely they are to enact their power over somebody else in that violent situation. So they're starting to say, like, well, I'm going to control everything here at home. No, you can't have any privacy. No closed doors. Give me your cell phone. I'm also going to control who you talk to and how you talk to them. And then that isolating factor on top of a pandemic grows even more. Yeah. So now you can't get out the house to go run groceries. You can't drop somebody off at school. You're not being a part of a regular church group. And so we're seeing those calls increase worldwide and those needs increase worldwide.
Ashley Fetters, what would you add to this important part of the conversation?
Sure. I mean, I think it's, something that we're sort of underlining here is that, this is kind of the worst possible situation for domestic violence and for family violence. It's getting worse because of all these external factors. You know, people treat their families worse if they have, those sorts of tendencies when things get bad. And then it's also harder to get out and it's harder for help to reach these folks who need it. When I've talked to domestic violence advocates, they've talked about, how oftentimes you make plans and find ways to help someone leave the situation when their abuser is out of the house or when they're out of the house. And when no one's leaving the house, it's much harder to make that plan for how to extract someone from the situation.
So, Lex, what would you tell someone who may be in that situation in this moment?
And this is something that Ashley touched on earlier. It might be time to start suggesting building a pod. Right? So saying like, this has been a really long haul. We do need some help, especially if it's a family, right? If you're having children, saying like, maybe we should introduce, these couple of other families so they can all school together, and trying to figure out other ways to introduce folks into a system. And sometimes it might be, well, this place is safer. Why don't I run out to this place to try and do whatever to start to separate from that individual. We've also started to see some social media movements where folks will post, hey, if you ask me about my grandmother's Cinnabon recipe, I will know that you're needing help. And I will either call the police, and just be aware if you're calling the police to a Black person or person of color's home, just to give folks a heads up, because sometimes that doesn't feel safe for all people. But if they're in need of help and police, then saying, I will call the police for you. I will reach out for you. And using some of that coded messaging, there used to be calling to order for a pizza as well. And saying, if you call a police number and order a pizza, they know that you need immediate help. And we're using a lot of those veiled techniques to try and have people be able to reach out in supportive ways. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for that. I think that's very important and wanted to get to that this hour. We just have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to hear from you both what you would tell couples generally, new couples, couples that have been together for a long time during this period of pandemic. What would you tell couples to cultivate, ways to cultivate their relationships in a better way? Ashley Fetters, I'll start with you.
Oh, goodness. Well, this is one of these moments when communication is key, right? I mean, communication is always key. I'm sure that's what Lex would say, too. But right now, speaking up when you are lonely, or speaking up when you need some space, speaking up when you're overwhelmed and can't handle, the way the division of labor is falling in your household, like, this is the moment when it is most crucial to communicate those feelings and be upfront about these things. So I guess that would be my advice to couples, is just, communicate, but do it constructively. Be as kind to you as you can to your partner.
and as you write, Ashley, crisis can be a turning point. And for many people in this moment, it has been.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It has been.
Lex Brown James, what would you tell couples as a licensed marriage and family therapist in this very peculiar moment of pandemic?
So every conversation doesn't have to be a deep conversation about relationship and where you're going and your future and past mistakes. I'd also say, do spend some time by yourself, right? And working with each other to be flexible in what's going on. So maybe it doesn't have to happen just at 10 o'clock. Maybe it can happen at 10:30. So somebody can have just some time, whether it's alone time in the bathroom or whether it's alone time in the living room with the big TV, whatever it is. And then for folks who are separate, finding those ways to take care of your partner from afar. So maybe it's sending them a new plant that they loved or that they wanted. Maybe it's trying to support them by sending them a funny video of you being happy about something so they can practice some compersion and also be happy for you, right? And taking that time out to really check in for you and say, what do I want and what do I need? And then, as Ashley said, communicate that to them and see where they're willing to meet you where you're at.
Well, some really important words of wisdom and comfort as we all make our way through relationships during this period of pandemic. Ashley Fetters, reporter at The New York Times. Her piece is Move In, Get Divorced, The Pandemic Forces Couples to Decide. That's at our website, onpointradio.org. Ashley Fetters, thank you so much for your time and perspective today.
Thanks so much, Jane. It's been fun.
Thank you. Lex Brown James, licensed marriage and family therapist at the Institute for Sexuality and Intimacy. Lex, we appreciate your professional perspective. Thank you for being here.
I appreciate being here. Thank you so much, Jane.
Thank you. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
ESG, or environmental social governance, challenges businesses to think beyond the immediate bottom line. But before ESG, the Balanced Scorecard did something similar. Questrom's Eddie Riedel explains.
The big thing that was groundbreaking about the Balanced Scorecard is really this idea to move beyond thinking about financial statements, which everybody had thought about since the 1920s, right? That was kind of the gold standard for how to evaluate a company and its performance. And the Balanced Scorecard's big insight, I think, was to get companies internally to think about, well, what if you don't just focus on financial measures? There are other things that are going to affect your performance, and maybe they won't affect them today, but they're going to affect them in the short term, midterm, long term. Building in those other criteria, those other dimensions, and explicitly linking that to your strategy, to how your company is going to operate, what kind of big decisions it's going to make. That's really what the big insight of the Balanced Scorecard was meant to do. And at the time, right now, it doesn't seem particularly revolutionary. It seems kind of obvious. We've been stuck in the ESG movement for a while, and thinking about linking these things to corporate strategy seems pretty obvious. At the time, it was a pretty big, whoa, kind of moment.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.